Dr. David Chandler from the Chemistry Department at the University of California at Berkeley. He is an old colleague of mine. We were essentially graduate students together, more years than we care to mention, but we go back a long way. David did a BSc degree at MIT. All of his work has been in chemical physics, and his area is theoretical chemistry and statistical mechanics, but that's a rather broad definition. BSc at MIT, a PhD at Harvard, a postdoc at San Diego, and then he was gainfully employed at Illinois for 13 years, and then Penn State for 2.5, and at Berkeley for the past 7 years.
No, University of Pennsylvania.
I'm sorry. I take that back. He is somewhat in mourning because the San Francisco Giants lost yesterday. I think he has recovered. We had to go to dinner yesterday, and we were watching it up to, what, the fifth inning, was it?
Yeah.
It was 4-1, and it was very reluctant to leave. But fortunately, nothing transpired after that, so.
Or unfortunately.
And now I forgot the title. Tell them.
I'll give them. Okay, thank you. Yeah. Okay, so I'm today going to talk about the solution to a problem I started worrying about in 1996, and it took a few years to work through what its solution is. But let me describe to you what was on my mind in 1996. I was thinking about water molecules in liquid water, and imagine that you're riding on an oxygen atom in liquid water. The chances are overwhelming that you're sitting on an intact water molecule, H2O, right? Because pH is 7, so that means that it's only 1 in 10 to the 7 oxygens that are going to be not in that way. Well, if you sit on this oxygen and you're patient, and you wait about 10 hours, then that particular intact water molecule in that time scale, on average, will give up one of its protons to the surrounding liquid, and it'll become a hydroxide ion, and the proton will swim away as part of a hydronium ion. Okay. The process that takes place that lets that happen, we know from experiments by Eigen and more recently by Bradley Moore and his group, that process takes place in less than 5 or 10 picoseconds. In other words, you have to wait about 10 hours for it to happen. The half-life of a water molecule, intact water molecule in liquid water at standard conditions is about 10 hours. But when whatever it is that occurs happens, it happens very, very quickly on the time scale of picoseconds. This oxygen, this intact water molecule becomes a hydroxide and also gives birth to the nascent hydronium ion somewhere else nearby. So what is it that happens? That's what I was trying to think about. What happens that makes that process occur? It's an important process. That's the fundamental kinetic step of pH of water is giving up a proton to the water. Now, I'm a theorist, not an experimentalist, so I wanted to figure out what the answer to this question was using theoretical techniques, perhaps techniques that are up in my head, or perhaps techniques that are orchestrated by my head but actually go on in a digital computer. So let's just think our way through what this involves if I'm going to use a digital computer. Suppose that I've got a very, very fancy numerical algorithm that is true to the force fields in liquid water even when the water molecules are not intact. In other words, it's calculating the electronic structure of molecules on the fly. And I have a very fast computer that within one or two orders of magnitude can take a physical time step in about one CPU second. Okay, now, what's a physical time step? This is Institute of Applied Mathematics, so I don't know. Do you know? It's supposed to be a femtosecond. Somebody got a Nobel Prize for saying that. So you have the basic time scale for physical motion in a molecule, vibrational motion, is of the order of 10 to the minus 15 seconds, a femtosecond. Okay. So if I'm going to integrate equations of motion on a computer with this fancy force field and things like that, my basic mathematical steps have to involve that basic physical time step. So that's a femtosecond. So one femtosecond translates into one CPU second plus or minus a couple orders of magnitude, depending on how fast your computer is and how detailed your modeling is and so forth. Now, well, I think you can do this in your head. I mean, how many CPU seconds do I need if I just want to run straightforwardly and see this one picosecond event, that 10 to the minus 12 second event? It's a very short event, but it's somewhere in this long 10-hour. Well, obviously, I can't mimic this system on a computer for what would correspond to 10 hours. So straightforward trajectory type of calculations with whatever bells and whistles you want to put on it, that can't solve the problem. I can't find out what was happening. All right. Now, what is it that I'm looking, what is it that I would like to look for? Imagine a trajectory that does extend over 10 hours of physical time. And somewhere in that long line, there's a little snippet that's 10 to the minus 12 seconds long, that's a picosecond long, that contains this interesting event. So if I were to look at all of the trajectories that were one picosecond long, right? I mean, I would need something of the order of, it's one. There's one possibility out of 10 to the 15 that I'm going to find this little trajectory that's got the interesting thing, right? Now, what is this interesting thing like? Well, if we liken stable chemical states to basins or valleys in some kind of mountain range, the kind of thing I'm trying to figure out is analogous to the following puzzle. I'm marching through a landscape, a very, very rugged mountain range. And I have equipment that can tell me where I am at a given point in time as far as latitude and longitude. And I know the address or what the latitude and longitudes are for the valley I'm in, and I also know the address for the valley I'd like to get to. And I have the energy to walk for 2 hours from one valley to the next, but I don't know the passageway to get from one valley to the next, and it's a very rugged and mountain range, so if I just launch out and go somewhere, it'd be hard to find it. Now, that would especially be true if it were in the dark. Now, the problem I want to solve with the water order dissociation is much like being as if I'm blindfolded or in the dark, because the landscape there has the dimensionality of the intermolecular potential surface or the force field surface. We're talking about at least hundreds of molecules that will be involved. So we can't visualize that. There's no way that we can literally visualize exactly what this landscape looks like. So it's as if you're blindfolded. You have to be able to find your way in the dark. Now, In this mountain range, I have a rope that can extend over a distance that is as long as I can walk in 2 hours, and I have a strong arm. Okay, so my arm is the metaphor for a CPU or a computer, and the rope's length is my metaphor for how long I want to run this computer. Okay. So now, in the dark, I think my plan will be I'm going to throw this rope, and I have a friend in the other valley, and if that rope gets into the other valley, my friend will grab the rope and give it a little tug, and so I'll know that my rope has successfully gotten to the other valley, and then I can just walk along the rope, and I can feel my way along this pathway, and I'll even know when I've stopped going uphill and started going downhill. I'll even know where the bottleneck was or the mountain pass was that I went through. Could do all of this stuff in the dark. Of course, how is it that I'm going to successfully throw this rope from my initial valley to the valley where my friend is in the dark? In my first throw, the chances are that it successfully finds this narrow passage over to the other valley is negligible. Second time I throw it, it's still negligible. I've got 2 hours of energy. It doesn't seem like I can do this unless I can learn from each mistake in some sort of optimum way, and perhaps that optimum way is efficient enough that I won't expend too much energy throwing the rope and I'll find my passage. Got the idea? So if I could solve that mathematical problem, that would do that kind of a problem, learn how to throw these ropes and learn from my mistakes in some optimal way, perhaps I could figure out then how water autodissociates if I have a fast computer and a fancy procedure for estimating interim molecular potentials and things like that. So that's the story I'm going to tell you about, is how one does this. Now, let's try to take this cover off so I can... Oops, okay. So beginning from the simplest possible view of all of this, there's some basin of attraction, which on energy scales or free energy scales that are small compared to thermal energies, I have to find my way through a bottleneck to another basin. And I know, in general, if I have to wait 10 hours for this process to happen, that's the half-life for the autodissociation of water. If I have to wait 10 hours, but I also know that the actual event only takes about a picosecond or so, it means that there's some narrow passageway that I have to get through. And so the objective might be to let's find this narrow passageway. And why don't I do the following? I'll calculate the reversible work to walk to that bottleneck. That reversible work, that's a free energy change by the Boltzmann principle, that gives me the probability of being at that bottleneck. Then I'll take a member of the ensemble that I'm studying. By figuring out the reversible work, I'm reversibly moving along, so I'm studying many, many states. I get over here, I have an ensemble of states, and from each state I'll run a trajectory from this point and compute the probability that, given that I'm at this bottleneck, I transmit through it. Now that should work, right? I just, maybe in 10 steps I move to the bottleneck, I have to do some kind of equilibration of my system, my water, and here's the intact water molecule, there's the dissociated water molecule, charge-separated species, and so I just, let's say each step, I have to equilibrate water. I have a pot of 100 water molecules. That each run should be maybe 1 or 10 picoseconds of physical time. That's manageable CPU time. So I'll put it there, and I'll just run trajectories. Now, that is the theoretical cop-out of chemical dynamics. I can denigrate it because I'm one of the people who pioneered this methodology in the context of liquid phase reactions. Well, the reason why it's a cop-out is that in order to use this procedure that I've just described, which certainly does work if you could use it, is I had to know where this bottleneck is. Knowing what that bottleneck is means I already understood the mechanism. Now, in this water-order dissociation problem, I have no idea what the mechanism is for how this intact water molecule, once every 10 hours, undergoes a picosecond trajectory and comes apart. I have no idea what's causing that. I don't know what coordinates to control. Let me give you an idea of how dangerous it would be to proceed without what is sort of a traditional way of thinking about it, without knowing what you're doing. Here's a schematic of some potential energy surface in two dimensions, where the coordinate Q seems to be a reasonable order parameter to describe whether you're in this basin or you're in that basin, which basin you're in. And let us suppose that because you actually look at this thing, this would be like in the water molecule case, I can think of a variable that is very much like Q. It's the distance between the proton and the oxygen, the proton that's going to be donated and the oxygen. And when that proton is close to the oxygen, Q is small, and I have an intact water molecule sitting in liquid water. And when Q is large, I have a dissociated species. That seems good enough. So why don't I just calculate the free energy to change this coordinate, which I do know about? And in this diagram, drawn with malice aforethought, the kinetics is not controlled by Q. In fact, it's controlled by another variable that I don't know about yet, that is perpendicular, orthogonal to this coordinate. Well, I don't know about that, so I just carry out a reversible work calculation of dragging Q from this region to that region. And what that reversible work is the log of the partition function for the variable Q prime, given that Q is constrained. So I think I see there's a minimum there, there's a minimum there. The extremum for that is at this point over here. So there's my apparent bottleneck, if I only know about Q. Now imagine that I took that coordinate and I started running trajectories off of there. There'd be a negligible probability that I could transmit through this surface to this side. Right? So in fact, the dynamics, if I ran the dynamics, I would discover, gee, there's some mysterious thing going on that doesn't let me get any kind of transmission through this barrier. Well, the fact is, the barrier isn't the barrier. The barrier is over there. Okay, so now you might say that, oh, well, this is a simple little counterexample to something that is more likely to occur not in this fashion. And in fact, this type of behavior turns out to be more the rule than the exception. Basically because in a complicated system, there are so many things going on, it would almost be a miracle that the kinetic pathway would involve precisely the coordinates that you look at to characterize the basins of attraction. The dimensionality is too high. It would have to be almost a miracle that you would know this. And I'll give you a couple of examples. All right, this one has to do with the what's called a hydrophobic effect. Namely, if you have two oily surfaces in water, if the oily surfaces are close enough together, the bad surface energy that's associated with water in contact with the oil will destabilize the favorable bulk free energy that would keep this as a liquid. And the simple dimensional analysis would show that if you put these plates closer together than this distance, where gamma is the surface tension, and these are the chemical potential differences between liquid and gas, that you have gotten to the point where the free energy of the bulk, which is favored over the vapor, is destabilized because of the surface. And this length is very large. If you just plug in the thermodynamic values here for the surface tension and the density, and this turns out to be hundreds of nanometers. Now, one way to think about this in terms of the free energy for a variable rho, which is telling you the density of the material in between the plates, is to think, well, if the distance between the plates is large, then, of course, the high-density phase is the stable one. If the distance between them is short, then the vapor phase is the stable one. The density, the number of particles per unit volume that are in this interior region, that certainly is a good variable to describe. That's a good order parameter. But is it a good kinetics description of what's going on? Well, if you on a computer did a simulation of this event, which people have done, if you were controlling the density, you would end up producing a thin film between the two plates, and that thin film would eventually become unstable to thermal fluctuations when it was thin enough, and you would break up like that. And that would be the pathway you might think about if you thought that you could use this order parameter to control the kinetics. But that isn't what happens. Instead, what does happen is that there's a pathway of much lower free energy costs. And perhaps one could deduce this by just thinking, but we've deduced it by doing simulations of a sort that you'll learn about soon. And what really does happen is that there are fluctuations of the free interface, or the nearly free interface next to the oily surface. Once in a while, there's a free energy fluctuation where this interface gets close enough to this interface that the two of them become one interface, and it ruptures, and the system comes apart. That's the pathway. So the pathway has to do with fluctuations of interfaces, not fluctuations of bulk densities. Right. So that's an example of this picture that I showed. It's exactly this kind of a thing. Now, let's see, we can go on. Here's another example that's more evocative of chemistry. In this case, imagine a dimer of sodium and chloride that are solvated in water. If the sodium and chloride are close together, they form a nice ionic bond. The potential of mean force, or the free energy, as a function of the distance between the sodium and chlorine looks as shown. And so this is computed with reasonable force fields and two ions in a box of water on a computer. And the dissociated pair shares a water between them. Now, if you were in the gas phase and you had a sodium and a chlorine, you'd say, well, it's obvious that not only is the order parameter the distance between the two ions, describing whether they're in contact or dissociated, but it's got to be the reaction coordinate. My heavens, what else is going on in the system in the gas phase? But that's not what's happening in the liquid. And if one wants, at the end of the lecture, if you want to know more details about this, we can talk about it, but I will just tell you the following facts about this particular thing. If you compute the transmission probability to cross this surface, so that's the least probable place to find the separation between a sodium chloride, so you'd think that's where the, if you're only controlling the distance between the sodium chloride, you'd think that may be where the bottleneck is. If you do it and calculate transmission probability, this flux, which is the standard calculation, I'm calculating the flux across that surface given that you dissociated at a later time average, It turns out that that flux is an order of magnitude less than its initial value, less than the transition state theory value. So the probability is less than a tenth that you transmit through this surface. Something else is going on, you would think. And in fact, what it is almost obvious from this sort of a picture. How is it that the sodium and chloride would ever come apart if the water remained solvating these things? What you need to have is a fluctuation in the water around these ions so that there's space for the sodium to move away. And it turns out that the reaction coordinate, the thing that controls this dynamics, is not the separation between the ions. What happens is first you have a fluctuation in the solvent so that there's room for the ions to come apart. Then the ions move apart. It's a little more complicated than that. You also want to have some dipole fluctuations so that there's also a force that pushes them apart. But there has to be this room. So it's actually, so the controlling dynamics for this dissociation in the solvent are solvent coordinates, not the coordinates of the solutes that are.
Does that change the local dielectric constant? Is that another way to think of that?
No.
No.
Yeah, this is a packing effect.
Okay.
I mean, there just isn't any room. If you drew the space filling size of these things, there's no room for them to come apart. That's not a dielectric constant. So, okay. So, you know, if you're a chemical dynamicist, and you say, look, this is obvious. If you have the wrong transition state surface, you don't really describe the kinetics. What are you telling us all about this for? I mean, after all, give me a potential energy surface, and I can do some kind of local gradient examination, and take steps on the surface, and I'll locate the saddle point. And once I've got the saddle point, I'll know where the bottleneck is, right? Well, that isn't right. That's too simplistic. That's really only right for problems that are such low dimensionality. They seem to be very interesting. Here's a caricature of something that is interesting. We have a rough, rugged mountain range, two basins of attraction. And as we look at this picture, even though it's in two dimensions and the real systems we're interested in are in 100 dimension or even higher, one thing that this illustration shows you is heavens. In a high dimensional problem, the great majority of saddles and hills and valleys have nothing to do with what I'm interested in. They're not the important features of the potential that get me from this basin to that basin. Now, there are some screwballs that actually go about. I mean, you read papers in JCP, even Science and Nature, and this, where people go around, they take some landscape, and they go about, or their graduate students go about, and they calculate every single feature they can, you know, until they have like 10 to the 5 features. And that's silly, because you don't... It's a very tiny fraction, and in fact, in the limit of a big system, it's an infinitesimal fraction of the potential energy landscape that's relevant for the dynamics. Just as, you know, in the equilibrium statistical mechanics, the important regions of configuration space are an infinitesimal fraction of all of configuration space. You only sample those regions of configurational space which are within KT of the minimum, and KT is a microscopic number. So the important part of the potential energy surface is minute compared to the total part. And the same thing is true when you start thinking about trajectories that get you from one place to the next. You want to know what's important for the trajectories. So what you want to do is some kind of important sampling that focuses not on states, not on minima, maxima, and things like that sort, but you want to focus on the trajectories, the space of trajectories that get you from one region to the other. So I want to do important sampling to find...
Wouldn't you have to say, though, if this does depend on temperature? Because obviously with thermal fluctuations, if you're really at high temperature, you may just smooth that whole surface out, so you don't see.
Yeah, so as I tried to show in the first, what I'm thinking of is all features that I put down are on a scale of KT. So as KT goes up, I mean, then we don't have bottlenecks and things of this sort. I'm talking about features that are of the order of KT. And in a large system, the number of features of the order of KT grow exponentially. So that's so no matter what temperature you're at, if there is a bottleneck, then there are other features that get down to smaller and smaller scales. Okay. All right, so my thread was wrecked a little bit there. Let me get back. So we were looking for, at the very beginning, I said I'm interested in finding this trajectory or set of trajectories or ensemble of trajectories, each one of which is only, let's say, a picosecond or 2 picoseconds long, that exhibit this event that happens only once every 10 hours on average, right? So it's a very, very rare 1 or 2 picosecond trajectory I'm looking for. So in the ensemble of all 1 or 2 picosecond trajectories, I'm looking for this minute fraction of those trajectories, but that's the important ones that I want to find. So I need some kind of important sampling to find that part of trajectory space. Now, how do you do important sampling? Let's begin and then juxtapose. Let's begin with thinking about important sampling of the traditional sort that we do with ordinary statistical mechanics, with Monte Carlo or techniques like that. And then let's juxtapose what we would do in the context of trajectories. Now, in ordinary statistical mechanics, we're sampling or looking for doing important sampling in state space or in configuration space. So here's a schematic of the potential energy landscape versus configuration. And the log of the probability times minus KT, that's what we mean by the potential energy or free energy landscape in this case. And imagine that we're in the dark. We don't really know where this interesting configuration is. The dimensionality is so large, we don't know where it is. So we would like to have some systematic way to find this important region. So suppose we were plopped down over here. This would be the standard thing for those of you who've ever done Monte Carlo or molecular dynamics simulations, and you start with some initial condition that isn't really appropriate for the equilibrium of that system. And then you start trying to move in that space of variables, and you try to do it with some kind of important sampling. And if you were doing Monte Carlo, you could take a move. You could change x to x prime. If you had a method for making random steps in this space, you would take a move, and then you would compare the distribution change, the change of p at the new point compared to the probability at the previous point. And if this number went up, you would accept that move. And if it went down, you would reject it, except within some kind of... You'd attach yourself to some sort of thermal bath to allow yourself once in a while to go up in potential, but basically that's it. And so you would relatively quickly move down into this important region. If you did literally a quench with no random noise, then you could get stuck in a crevice like this. But as long as you have some random noise, you would keep on moving and moving, and you would eventually get to this region very, very quickly. You'd be driven to that. And that's how you do Monte Carlo important sampling. There's all sorts of ways you can get stuck with this method. We all know about this, and we know that there are methods like simulated annealing and parallel tempering where you can try to avoid these methods or correct for the problems that you might have for getting tripped. But it's a relatively robust procedure, one for which you can actually check whether you're consistent with equilibrium and so forth. So now, imagine you want to look at trajectory space. How could you do basically the same thing? Well, in standard statistical mechanics, you need to have a random, one element you need is a random, a way of making a random move, a step, a random walk step in configuration space. So I need a way to make a random walk step in trajectory space. How might I do it? This is one method, but there are others, but this is the easiest to kind of visualize, and it works quite well, quite often. Here's a trajectory, which is really a chronological list of where we've visited points in phase space or configuration space, if you want, and for a trajectory of length t. And imagine that we haven't said how we've gotten this yet, but imagine we have one trajectory, the gold one, that is taking me from region A to region B. That's a member of the ensemble I'm interested in. And now, at any point at random along this gold trajectory, I can take a point at random, and I can change its momentum in a way that's consistent with whatever ensemble I'm in. If I'm in a microcanonical ensemble, I would make a move of momentum on a random energy shell. And then I could fire my new trajectory, the blue one, forward and backward in time from that point, so that the net trajectory is of length t again. And I could then, I'll call that my random walk step. How would I decide whether I wanted to accept it? Well, what are the trajectories I want? I want to take trajectories from an ensemble that has a distribution of initial conditions. That's whatever the experiment prescribes. It need not be an equilibrium one. It might be some other one. And I have a condition, a statistical characterization of basin A, and I have a characterization of basin B, and these occupation numbers, some statistical characterization. And now, if I fire a trajectory, I have a trajectory. The gold trajectory has one value for this number, and the blue trajectory has that value. And I can now accept or reject the blue trajectory based upon this comparison.
So you don't take into account any of the initial and intermediate points in the trajectory?
I don't care about those. I want to know the ensemble. I may want to examine that later on, and we'll talk about that two slides from now. But all I'm interested in is I have a characterization, because I understand reasonable order parameters for the intact water molecule sitting in liquid water. And I characterize and I can unambiguously characterize some region of configuration space, doesn't have to be contiguous with it, with the first one, of where the molecule is, the molecules have auto-dissociated and there's charge separation. And I want to find the ensemble of, or sample the ensemble of trajectories that take me from those two regions. After I've got that ensemble, I can look at it and learn about what's happening in between. And we'll get to that. But this at least says I know how to take a random walk step, and I know how to weight the random walk step according to what I'm interested in. Now, one thing that is quite advantageous about this way of thinking about it is, what is the numerical work involved in carrying out this calculation? What is the computational cost? Well, it scales linearly with the number of trajectories. If I wanted to look at 1,000 trajectories, I need the computational resources to run a straightforward trajectory for 1,000 times t time steps. So it scales linearly. So as long as I need to know about trajectories, I can't beat this method. I can beat it maybe by factors of 50% or something like this, but basically there can't be a faster procedure to use in this. We haven't demonstrated it works yet, but this has to be then among the class of algorithms that are optimum. Now, how is it that we got that initial trajectory? In the previous transparency, I asked you to just think about a trajectory that was part of the ensemble I'm interested in and take another step and see whether or not I get another one in that part of the ensemble. But how did I get that first one? Well, let's go back again and think about what you would do with ordinary statistical mechanics to just find a configuration that you were interested in. And this involves reversible work procedures. The simplest reversible work procedure I can think of is the famous piston experiment. In this case, I have a region that confines my atoms to this volume, and I'm wondering what the probability is that my atoms will fall in a smaller subvolume, as shown over here. That probability would be the exponential of minus 1 over kt times the reversible work to get me from here to there. And of course, if this is a macroscopic system, that reversible work grows extensively with the number of particles, so you could wait for the age of the universe and you wouldn't see the gas all fill just a subsection of this one. Nevertheless, you could ask for that probability. It's a very small probability, and you could actually compute it. You could exactly compute it, and the way you would do it is by carrying out a reversible sequence of steps going from this ensemble to that ensemble. So the partition function, where you have all the particles confined in here, to the partition function where you have all the particles confined in the smaller volume. And on your computer, what you would do is run a calculation long enough to equilibrate the system with this operator characterizing that volume. Then you would change this operator ever so slightly in the direction towards that operator, and you would run another simulation, and you would keep on going, and you would tabulate on the computer the mechanical work that was done to carry out that reversible sequence of steps. And that's how you calculate free energy changes on a computer. It doesn't have to be this simple-minded thing. You might be interested in the probability that a protein has this conformer rather than that one, and you can do that, and people do it. Now, in trajectory space, the partition function for the trajectories that we want is the sum over all trajectories with the initial distribution, the characterization of the initial state, the characterization of the final state. But we could ask, how about, what's the reversible work to change that ensemble starting with the ensemble where we just launch trajectories from A and we don't say where they're going? In other words, we replace this characteristic function HB with just the number 1. So if we could carry out a sequence of simulations which just stepwise change the boundary conditions of going from 1 to HB, we actually will then calculate the reversible work to create the ensemble of trajectories we want. And we'll also, at the end of the day, have that ensemble of trajectories. So this is how you control the ensemble, not the trajectories. This is an important thing. We're not putting our hands on the trajectories. We're putting our hands on the ensemble restrictions, on the constraints on the ensemble, and we're changing those reversibly. So we basically have created a thermodynamics, or a statistical thermodynamics, of trajectory space with this. And interestingly, if you look at the physical meaning of this ratio, well, this is the probability that trajectories start at point A, and they arrive at point B, given they start at A, they arrive at point B a time t later. Well, after an initial transient time, this grows linearly with rate, right? This is the rate constant times t. So this free energy change, this is an exponential of a reversible work to change trajectory space, that gives you the rate constant. So in this statistical thermodynamics of trajectories, then we have a way of computing rates. Now, once we have those trajectories, we might like to interpret them and find out where this bottleneck is that we didn't know in the first place, and then understand the mechanism. And how would you do that? Here's a schematic of some landscape that was really too complicated to visualize in reality, and with a basin here and a basin there that we know how to characterize in some fashion with some water parameter. And the heavy black line represents one of the trajectories we've harvested. Perhaps we've harvested 1,000 different trajectories by this Monte Carlo procedure I described, Monte Carlo through trajectory space. Then we can take a point on that trajectory and we can launch, let's say, a dozen independent trajectories from this configuration, and calculate the probability that trajectories launched from here end up in that basin or end up in that basin. And here we'd find that the probability, we call that the committer of this point, is highly biased towards A. Over here, highly biased towards B. At least once, maybe three times, maybe five times, maybe seven times, some odd number of times, a trajectory that you've harvested will pass through a point that has equal probability of having trajectories launched from it going to either A or B. And that would be that separatrix, if the world were so simple to have it as a separatrix, that would be the a statistical characterization of the transition state. And the members of the ensemble which satisfy this criteria, that's the transition state ensemble. That's where your bottleneck is statistically. If you're to the one side of it, you have a greater probability of going to this basin. The other side, you have a greater probability of going to the other basin. Okay, that's basically the whole methodology, and we're going to show two examples of applying it. But I want to first describe to you the people who worked this all out. Primarily, these ideas were initiated with Christoph DeLago and Peter Bolhaus, who were two postdocs in my group back in the 1990s. And Christoph is now an assistant professor at University of Rochester. In January, he becomes a full professor at the University of Vienna. Peter Bolhaus is on the faculty at the University of Amsterdam now. Phil Geisler, who nowadays, if you see him, he has short hair. But in any case, Phil Geisler, there he is as a second-year graduate student. And he and most of the others in the group were becoming fascinated with the things that that Christoph and Peter were working on. And Phil started extending these methods, combining them with ab initio molecular dynamics and a variety of other interesting things. And the two applications I'm going to show are based on work that are examples of work he did using transition path sampling. That's what this methodology is called. Kaa Lum was interested in the hydrophobic effect, and she used transition path sampling to understand this dynamics of water evaporating between two hydrophobic plates that I described as an illustration at the beginning of my lecture. Gavin Crooks is the kind of graduate student you're really proud of, but you're also incredibly frustrated with. He never did anything I ever asked him to do, but he wrote a beautiful thesis, published several papers, using the ideas of transition path sampling to talk about the thermodynamics and statistics of systems driven very far from equilibrium. Some of the results that come out of his formulation very simply are Jasinski's equality and also the cone fluctuation theorem and so forth. Let's see, Jin Lee was a visitor from Korea who used these methods to study transformations of water clusters. So that's the group that did it. So now let's talk about an illustration. Now, we want to get to water coming apart in liquid water, so we want to have some confidence with the force field and also some of the methods. So we decided to start out simply and just talk about a reaction involving three water molecules with an extra proton. So this is a protonated water trimer. And the process that we're interested in is, here you see oxygen number one carries the three protons. At the end of the day, oxygen two carries it. So there's been some chemistry going on between one and two. And since I'm at Berkeley, I can talk about particle three being the solvent, right? So I have a one molecule solvent. All right. And so we want to understand the mechanism of how this happens. In a fraction of a picosecond, namely about a third of a picosecond, this process is completed, but the time scale that it occurs over is of the order of 10 to the minus 4 seconds. That's the half-life of this configuration. This has never been studied experimentally, but theoretically you can use different force field models. There's an empirical force field model that Frank Stillinger and David created, and if you use their force field model, the time scale for this to happen, the half-life of this cluster is about a second. There's what's called an empirical valence bond model that Daniel Borges and his group worked on, and if you use their force field, we compute it to come out to have a half-life of 10 to the minus 5 seconds. Greg Voth has one that 10 to the minus 2 seconds. And if you use density functional theory as the sort used in Carr-Perrinella molecular dynamics, which uses a blip functional for the density function, you get 10 to the minus 4. If you do MP2 or a variety of other higher-level quantum calculations, it's always about 10 to the minus 4. So the right answer is 10 to the minus 4, but I just want to show it. Depends on force field, obviously. Interestingly, the mechanism is more or less independent, all of these the precise numbers. And so what we did, the first thing we did was to study the kinetics in the way I was describing. Namely, we wanted to calculate this correlation function that takes you from A to B. We harvested these with transition path sampling in the way I described. After a little more than a tenth of a picosecond, you see that this correlation function does become linear. The slope of it there is the rate constant. We did this at a variety of conditions. This is a microcanonical calculation, and here's with a variety of different energies for the clusters. Here's the rate constant plotted, and then there's a dotted line, a vague little dotted line there that's the RKM theory, and it's not bad. It's within about a factor of 10 or so of the actual results. Except something interesting happens at high energies where you see that this linear behavior changes and you're starting to pick up the manifestation of the fact that there are really two bottlenecks in this system, a high energy one and a low energy one, and we'll talk about those in a minute. Somehow I thought I had the transparency. Yeah, but let's. Whoa. Sorry, folks. Sorry I slipped on that. But let me just show you a typical trajectory of what happens. And in fact, before you look at the trajectory, let me go back one. Who wants to guess how that happens? What's the reaction coordinate? Does anybody want to try? Come on, there's some good kineticists in the audience. I mean, you know, you might think, well, I should just, the position of that proton, maybe that's the right coordinate?
Proton transfers to 3, collides with 2, and then it's transferred to 2.
No.
Well, you said yes.
Well, you know, think about what is the low energy motions of this object. Think if there's a low energy way to get that proton to move over. The lower the energy way, the more likely it's going to be. Well, the low energy motion is the bending of this angle. So that means that the solvent has to move over here, eventually move over there. When it moves over there, then the proton has moved over. Got the idea? So it's a solvent-assisted proton transfer, where my solvent is this one molecule. And here's the Carr-Perrinello molecular dynamics trajectory of it, a few snapshots. And I told you that the transition state is when you're at a point where there's an equal probability that trajectories launched from that configuration will go either way, and that happens right over here in this series of things. And you can see this solvent is moving over, goes on over. And so that's the mechanism. It's kind of a simple little problem, but it kind of, you get an idea of what to do. One of the other things to note, of course, is that if you remember this CPMD, Carr-Perrinello Molecular Dynamics, is using a force field that's pretty good, so we'll probably use that one. In fact, we will. And one thing that's interesting is that there are really two transition states that look like this. The transition path sampling eventually finds them doing this random walk in trajectory space. And so there are really two sub-ensembles, some that cross this this structure and the other which cross that one. Okay, so now we're going to talk about, and this will end the lecture, how it is that this phenomenon occurs, the auto dissociation of water. And here's a picture of one of the systems that we looked at with Carr Parinel molecular dynamics. This is a 32-molecule system, periodically replicated, so in that sense it's an infinite system, but it's infinite only in the sense that while it goes on and on for space, its fluctuations are periodically replicated. All right. And drawn because we've seen what happens are a pertinent set of water molecules at the beginning of the day in these trajectories. This is representative of about 20 statistically independent trajectories that we harvested. So that meant we harvested of the order of about 100 trajectories. We show you a series of water molecules that happen to be connected through a hydrogen bond connectivity. And about a tenth of a picosecond later, on a time scale where it occurs only once every many hours, we have there's a hydroxide ion, and the hydronium sits. Which do I got? Well, when we go through the thing slower, I can't tell. Oh yes, here we go. This is the hydronium, and this is the hydroxide ion. So the charge is separated. So let's see how that trajectory works. So these are snapshots taken every 30 femtoseconds, every 30 times 10 to the minus 15 seconds. Here's what happens. So at time zero on this trajectory, we have these water molecules, the ones that are highlighted, because that's where something interesting is going to happen. 30 femtoseconds later, we see that a dissociation has happened. Namely, this oxygen has acquired 3 protons, and this one, the blue one, has only 1. So that means that a proton from here has moved over here, and then from here, this extra proton has moved there. Now, this is a kind of procedure by which protons move along hydrogen bonding wires that Grotius imagined in when? Does anybody know about the... Grotius wrote a paper in 1804 where he proposed that the reason why water had the conductivity it did is because a proton would move from one oxygen where it's stuck onto it to the next one, and then that would dislodge a proton here that would move here and move there. He didn't know the stoichiometry of water. He thought water was OH. But nevertheless, this idea of one of the protons moving, that's basically correct, and his name is stuck with this thing. So that's called the Grotius mechanism. Now, what has happened going from here to here is that there's been a very large electric field fluctuation from the neighboring water molecules, but waters don't have to move very far to create a very large electric field fluctuation, but large enough to dislodge a stable proton. Right, so this is an electric field that gives rise to an energy that's comparable to a volt. Right, that happens in water very rarely, on the order of hours of time. And when it happens, it only persists for tens of femtoseconds because it's occurring because of the librational motion of the water molecule. So if I have a water molecule, this is oxygen, water. This motion happens very quickly on timescales of just a few picoseconds, that it librates back and forth. And serendipitously, you could get a collection of water molecules to fluctuate into such a position that there's a huge electric field over here that causes this charge separation, and that's what happens. If you try to decompose the electric field fluctuation into components coming from near neighbors, and you can't do that. It's really a collective thing coming from very many molecules. Now, at this point, If we take this configuration, randomize the momentum, and shoot a trajectory, overwhelmingly they come right back here. So even though there's been a birth of a huge electric field fluctuation that's destabilized this water, we have not passed out of the basin of attraction of the intact water molecules. 30 femtoseconds later, we see that this proton that was over here has moved a little bit further through this Grotthus mechanism. Again, if we take this configuration and randomize the momentum and shoot a trajectory, overwhelmingly this moves back very quickly to that configuration. That just means that these random fluctuations in water orientations, which are creating these electric fields, they persist for a very, very short period of time, and they're most likely going to run right back to the intact water molecule. All right. Now, 30 femtoseconds yet later, we have some further motion. In this case, the proton that was on the water molecule I'm circling has moved over to this hydroxide, and so now the hydroxide is where that oxygen was. Again, if I randomize the momentum and shoot a trajectory from this configuration, it goes right back to the intact case. But in the next 30 femtoseconds, something has happened. And what has happened is that this connectivity, this wire of donor hydrogen bonds, has broken. It's a random event. Hydrogen bonds make and break in water every couple of picoseconds. These fluctuations occur rarely on the time scale of hours, and they last for only about 10 or so femtoseconds. If it just so happens that rare electrostatic fluctuation, which destabilizes the thing, occurs when a hydrogen bond along that chain breaks, then there isn't a pathway for this to rush back. And it goes on and becomes a separated part. So the transition state is between this and this.
So which hydrogen bond broke? I couldn't see.
That water molecule just rotated. So there's no longer a short enough path. One of the things you can read about in this paper is the statistics of what the hydrogen bond lengths what the hydrogen bond wires, as we call them, have to be. If they're too long, they just don't work. And there's a distribution of hydrogen bond wires of this sort where there's this breakage. When the hydrogen bond wires connect, a short enough hydrogen bond wire, typically six or so water molecules involved, when that wire connects and there's a charge-separated species, then they reconnect with very high probability. Okay, so that's how it works. Seems kind of simple in retrospect. I just wouldn't have thought about the electric field, yeah, I guess. I mean, but then the idea that most of the time it doesn't work. It's really only 1 in 100 times that this large electric field will lead to the dissociation. One prediction we're making is that if somebody with time-resolved spectroscopy could see these events, then they should see that really you have hundreds of these kind of virtual dissociations of water which just don't last for more than tens of femtoseconds, and they come back before one of them does persist and the water molecule comes apart. It's not been seen experimentally, but I seems so sensible in retrospect that I'm sure it will be eventually. And so I'll stop there, and I can answer questions if you have any.
Thank you. No.
Brent? Yeah?
With your mechanism, I mean, this presumably was at 300K or something.
Yeah.
And at higher temperatures, if you increase temperature to 100 degrees or so, your hydrogen bonding will get pretty much wiped out. You won't have these wires or anything. Water will start looking quite ordinary.
Yeah.
Have you looked there? Does anything change?
No, we haven't. But that should be very interesting. I mean, it should be very interesting. Just like we know that the water dissociation of water in crystals is very, very much slower than it is in the liquid, and that's in the opposite direction. And I don't know. There should be, but I think what you're pointing out, and as I agree with, is that the effect should be interesting and non-monotonic, actually, how they're going to happen. That's right. Yeah?
You were saying that this serendipitous event, not necessarily getting all the way to the transition
space, yes,
but just to start it, like
yes,
B and C,
yes,
happens as a all of a sudden you happen to have an electrostatic field that supports this.
Yes.
Have you considered or looked at or thought about whether or not you might have self-interaction problems in a periodic cell of only 32 water molecules?
Yes.
And?
The free energetics, that errors that we're carrying along for this thing for finite size effects are of the order of a couple of kilocalories, which are certainly noticeable if we were trying to quantitatively calculate the rate. But they're not. It's not in the ballpark of these electron volt energies that we're interested in.
Yeah. Close to the 1 kilocal accuracy here.
Oh, of a quantum count. Yeah. The fact that you can talk about solvent-induced forces with even 32 water molecules, as long as you periodically replicate, this is, you know, within errors of the order of a few KT. This has been known for a long time with just simulations of a classical sodium and chloride ion in water that people have looked at that. Yeah. So it's not a new result that such a small system can handle things up to that size. Sometimes, though, your kilocalorie is the size effect you want to calculate, but that's not case here. Yeah.
I was a little confused early on because you had a slide showing a transition state.
Yes.
With equal probability of going back to reactants or products.
Yeah.
So then, is that a true trend? Is that really a transition state, or am I mean,
when you're talking about this?
Yes.
Yeah.
So if it's really a true transition state, when it gets to the transition state, doesn't it go to form products?
It goes in the direction it's pointed. So if you randomize momentum, it goes either way.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You're at the threshold. You can go either way. That's the transition state. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are the computational costs of the bomb? Are they that high?
Well, you know, Gren has been at meetings that I've been at where people have pointed out, well, you know, before Carparinello and molecular dynamics was invented, you use a huge amount of computing time. I don't even remember now the number of hours. They're actually cited in that science paper. I mean, I've never been involved with any kind of computation of this sort of expense. Just studying, in one case, 32, in another case, 64 water molecules periodically replicated. But you're calculating the electronic structure on the fly. So they are doable. But the only reason why, you know, we stop at 20 statistically uncorrelated trajectories is because, you know, we were exhausted, or we used up our computing resources, and so forth. You know, and this.
It'll go very well on a parallel machine.
What, pardon me?
Any cluster with an enormous number of processors can do this very well.
No. But still, I mean, you have to have, yeah. That's right. Another thing about parallelization of this transition path sampling is that it can be done with a hacksaw because you basically are just doing any. It's like any Monte Carlo. You don't even have to be smart, right? You just put different runs on different processors and just go. Yeah.
So actually, I'm a bit unclear about. Are you making a quantum calculation or a classical calculation?
The electronic structure is being calculated. It's a classical nuclear dynamics, and as the system is run, you know, for example, that trajectory, or in these cases, the nuclei are moving by the Hellman-Feynman forces, the classical forces, but the forces are calculated by averaging the electronic structure. And so you're in a ground state electronic structure, and you're calculating these on the fly with reasonably good quality quantum chemistry.
The positions of the hydrogens and the oxygen.
They're not classical. That's classical.
And you're solving for the wave functions of the
electrons. That's right. That's exactly right. And one thing, you know, one of the things that is interesting about this calculation, we have made quantum correction calculations to see, and they're very small. And the reason why they're very small is that you're not requiring this proton to move through a barrier to get over there. It's always being sloshed along in a minimum. As this heavy degree of freedom moves, the heavy degree of freedom is moving, and it's carrying the proton. There are higher energy pathways that could involve tunneling, but they're not the ones that are the primary ones in that case. And the same thing. What's interesting is that in this, you probably caught it, but I mean in this same sort of thing, again, it's the solvent moving, the heavier degrees of freedom moving that are pushing this proton along. But I don't want to say the quantum effects are negligible. They're not at all. I mean, librating a water molecule, you can, if you're talking about motion on a 10 femtosecond time scale, then the H bar omega is still pertinent energy compared to KT. So quantitatively, the quantum effects are there, but they're not qualitative, at least not in these two examples.
When you calculate the electron wave functions, is that Hartree Fock or is it something better?
No, this is density functional theory, right? So, and there's correlations put in with a square gradient that corrects the local density approximation. So this is what's called a blip functional. Yeah.
Hey, what was the density in this calculation?
This is 1 gram per cc, yeah.
And what was the effective dielectric constant, the average dielectric constant?
Gee, I don't know, but, I mean, people must have done dielectric constants with CPMD. They must be about right.
Between 50 and 100.
Yeah, I'm sure it must be between. it doesn't matter. After it's over 30 or so, it doesn't matter, because the effect you see is 1 minus 1 upon epsilon, right? That's the physical effect of the dielectric constant. So 1 minus 1 over 30 is, for all intents and purposes, 1 minus 1 over 80. You know, they're really not very different.
The diffusivity of that one solvent molecule looks like the right number?
Oh, yeah. The diffusion constant in the CPMD modeling of water is pretty good. Yeah. Also, people have...
The fluctuations in the hydrogen bond network was about picosecond. I thought it would be a little longer than that.
The hydrogen bond lifetime half-life for a hydrogen bond in water is about 2 picoseconds. And that's been measured, and it's been computed with different models. That's about it. And it coincides with, actually, the diffusion. That's how the water... it's another story, but basically, if you have my hand... This is one water molecule, that's another water molecule, okay? And there's a fluctuation out here where there's a free hydrogen bond. This guy moves over, grabs that hydrogen bond, moves like this. And so you have this breaking, reassigning of allegiances of hydrogen bonding, and that leads to strain networks, which leads to diffusion. And those are on that time scale.
Did you say, maybe I missed it, tunneling does not play a role because it doesn't, or because you don't know that it does or doesn't?
No, I'm telling you that the part of the potential surface that you're visiting with these things is that you're basically always sitting in minima as far as the protons are concerned, or going high up on a wall, but you're never penetrating to go to another state. So there'll be quantum effects associated with zero-point motion.
You have to get from one minimum to another.
Yeah, but the minima you're going to are controlled by heavy degrees of freedom. So the light degrees of freedom that would involve the quantum corrections are always being sloshed around in minima as the heavy degree of freedom moves. It's most easy to visualize in the case of the trimer. I mean, basically, this heavy degree of freedom, and you don't get a lot of tunneling with oxygens, is moving over, and as it moves over, this proton, its potential well is sloshing over. So it never has to go over the proton. From the proton's perspective, it doesn't have to go over a barrier. And that's the reason why. There's zero-point effects, but they're not really big.
Okay, yeah. One.
What?
Do the HO mu.
Oh, heavens, yeah.
Oh.
Yes, yeah.
Have you studied any solvation of ions, so metallic ions or...
Well, I haven't, but Mike Klein and his group have studied ionization of lithium and of sodium in water using CPMD. I mean, so there's a lot of literature on that. I haven't studied the ionization process or the solvation of separate ions, no. I mean, well, in a sense, I'm looking at it. I guess I shouldn't say that. I mean, this is... I mean, I do have solvated ions at the end of the day there, so I've looked at those. But what did you have in mind?
Because there are some classical mechanical simulations. They show that if you change the dielectric constant of the water, the ions is not solvated inside the water. It's actually on the outside of the cage. So I don't know whether, because
Cage. Well, I'm a little confused. There aren't any cages here. This is a bulk system.
Yeah, what? Bulk system. They have a finite number of water molecules.
So it's not. It's just a cluster of water. Right. Yes.
Then they put the
fine. Yeah.
Line in.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you change the dielectric constant of the water a little bit, and
how do you change the dielectric constant of a cluster of water?
Because they just set a parameter, right? So when they run the simulation, they can set up the three parameters.
There's a dielectric constant in a molecular dynamics simulation? I don't know this. We'll have to talk about it. I've never.
Yeah. Maybe we'll stop there.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, David.
Yeah.
I know the Giants lost.
Yeah.
Okay, but we'll give you a little cup.
Oh, wow. That's neat. I like that.